Well, we get going. We've only got to about 7:30-ish. So I'm just going to say this is the Bristol Radical Christian Group meeting tonight on the Haymarket. We are actually on the anniversary day, May the 4th, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
We are on the anniversary of the Haymarket affair, massacre, riot, depending on the political point of view, today. So, we were doing it today. Right, what we're going to do is I'm going to do a sort of shortish talk at the start about what happened around the Haymarket Massacre. We'll look a bit more at the context, because I didn't know a lot about what had happened before, what happened in Chicago. So I've looked a little bit back in history to sort of put in context, which actually turns out really important and actually quite shocking and interesting, what was going on in America prior to the 1886 event. And then after that, after we've done the Haymarket stuff, we'll have a little interlude where my comrade over here is going to do a little talk called I Love Lucy, as he does. And then that'll be a little interlude. And then the second part of this is a talk. We were going to call it The Tale of Three Monuments, Four Executions, and an angry streetcar driver. But it's kind of about how in Chicago the Haymarket has been contested, remembered, and fought over for the last 100 years, and it's basically a tale of three monuments. And we're doing that because we went out, some of the Bristol Radical Group went out to Chicago last year, and it was very interesting actually being in Chicago and going to all these sites, getting rubbins and stuff, which you can have a look at in a minute. So, and then a bit of discussions, and then probably a bit of coffee, and then I think there's an IWW meeting at 8 o'clock.
Yeah,
I think it's 8 o'clock. So we'll have to, if you're staying for that, we've got to stay, but eight-ish, we have to get out, really. So, I don't have to say anything else, have I? Oh, yeah, it'd be nice to put the donation at the end.
Always is.
But Millsy's not here, so collect it in his hat. Anyway, do you want to click the next one? Well, the first thing I'm going to say is, who reckons they know about the Haymarket?
I've never heard it.
Who's an expert? anyone who's an expert here? Great. the reason this talk came about was because there's people doing May Day events all week contacted us and said, would you like to do something around the May Day this year? And we said, well, obviously it'd be good to do a talk on the Haymarket. We've never done anything like this before, so I've been learning about it this week. I mean, I knew some stuff anyway, but kind of, so you'll have to, it's kind of Haymarket light, I suppose you'd call it. This is a famous picture, which is, I would call, a fanciful interpretation of what happened. You can see over here on the left here, there's some speakers standing on a wagon. I think these are policemen. This looks to me like a bomb's gone off, right? And then there's some bloke with a little hat on here shooting at the policeman. The policemen are shooting back, and there's a lot of people running away. So that's the kind of seminal image of the event. But I'll try and look in a little bit more depth about what actually happened, rather than perhaps how it was portrayed in the trials and obviously historically been fought over ever since. So if you can press the next one, Nick. Right, I just want to start with a little bit about Chicago, because I've never been to that city till last year, and I didn't really realise how important it was in the 19th century. So it's one of the, I suppose you could call it one of the mid-American or mid-historical grows the city. So you can say the early cities are colonial cities, like, you know, sort of New York and Boston and Quebec and Canada and the Americas, you know, these colonial cities which were kind of colonised in the 17th and 18th centuries. Then there's this middle phase in the 19th century where you get this massive capitalist expansion, particularly after the American Civil War. So you get these new cities arriving, places like Pittsburgh, Chicago, Cincinnati and St. Louis are all really growing massively fast in the 19th century. And then there's a later phase in the 20th century, places like Detroit, which appear, you know, as part of the kind of massive expansion of the US economy, particularly around the First and Second World Wars. So obviously Detroit is vehicles, you know, like somebody once said that, or a president said that the Second World War was won in Detroit. So there's these three phases of cities, the original colonial cities, the new 19th century cities, which are grow very rapidly in this later 20th century stuff. Now Chicago falls in this middle bracket. It's really grown in the 19th century, and I chose this map because it kind of shows the railroads in the 1880s. So I think the first railroads in America around 1829, something like that. You've got to butt in now, haven't you?
So just vaguely something about Chicago. It was a railhead, and they abattoir, so they deconstructed animals.
That's right. I was coming to that. The point about Chicago is, if you can see where it's situated, so this is obviously the east coast of America, pretty much going through to the Midwest, which sort of, now you could argue the Midwest starts at the end of the Great Lakes, really. So Chicago sits in this really strategic location. You can see this rail network. You know, there's a huge amount of rail lines going through Chicago. The key points are places like here, which is Toledo, which is like kind of, because of the Great Lakes create this big barrier, you get a huge amount of traffic moving just under the Great Lakes. You see the railroads run underneath them. Toledo, first of all, and then Chicago. And as Alan said, why Chicago is important is it was called the gateway to the West. So it sat in a really strategic location in terms of transport, but it also was the most developed city kind of moving into the Midwest, which wasn't that developed at this point, or certainly in the mid-19th century. So it's very, very important. It grows extremely fast, and it needs a huge amount of labour, and that labour is required for a whole load of industries. And obviously in this eastern area, you've got like steel and iron production and coal, like Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, St. Louis even. But Chicago's main importance was, although it had sort of heavy industries, including weaving and, you know, sort of textiles and all that kind of stuff. But what it's really doing, its function is to take all these goods from the West, the Midwest, take them eastward, but process them on the way. So, for example, as Alan said, you've got huge cattle markets, like huge amount of meat is being brought through Chicago and being processed and then moved eastwards to the big conurbations down the East Coast. Similarly, it's central to lumber production as well. A lot of lumber is moving down the rivers. I mean, you've heard of a log jam. I saw some pictures of a log jam the other day in a book. And this is where they were moving, you know, timber down the rivers, and massive amounts of timber. And they're really extremely dangerous jobs, like lumberjacks and the people who move the logs down the rivers. So there's a hell of a lot of major sort of employers, you know, a huge amount of light intensified labour in Chicago. And you can think about it, you might have big populations in the east that try to attract people to go westwards, right? But the point about Chicago is the wages are really, really low. It's a town that's run by a load of magnates, like capitalist magnates, whose main role was to really keep the wage rate down so that they could make massive profits out of what was going on. Consequently, a lot of the workers in the east, who were more often unionized and stuff like that, didn't move west, because there was no incentive to. So they start looking for where they can get labour from. Now, where they're getting that labour from, if you take the next slide. In Europe, in the 1870s to 1880s in particular, there's a European depression, and there's a huge amount of immigrant labour moving from Europe into the United States. And Chicago is one of the places they concentrate. And that's because, one, they're desperate, two, they haven't got many assets in the US, obviously, because they're immigrants, so they head to where they can get work, and Chicago is one of those places. So it rapidly grows, and a large number of those people are European immigrants, particularly Germans and Italians. So that kind of gives you an idea about the sort of makeup of the population. So a very new city with a huge amount of growth, with obviously bad housing and all sorts of other problems, but at the same time, you know, a very big concentration of European workers, many who couldn't speak English. You get a large number of Eastern Europeans, Germans, Italians, can't really speak English, they're learning English when they're there. So there are these kind of enclaves in the city of these different ethnic groups. But because of the nature of the industry, which is throwing everybody in together, everybody's mixing, Germans, Italians, Eastern European, Jewish workers. And that is where you'll see a lot of the activists who are central to the Haymarket affair come from. I just want to sort of take us a little bit back to the Civil War now. So I want to talk about what the main struggle that's going on in the Haymarket, which we might have heard of, is the struggle for the 8-hour day. After the end of the American Civil War, if I was going to draw an analogy, it's a bit like the end of the Second World War, really. It's like, you know, the working class in the Second World War have been through this misery, European war, and there's a kind of demand. You know, Britain, for example, you get the Labour Party, despite, you know, having Churchill, the war hero. And it's a little bit like that after the end of the American Civil War. It's obviously intense suffering. The South has been completely trashed. Slavery has ended. And there's a kind of demand amongst Northern, or, you know, people from the you know, the Yankees in the north, Yankee working class, to get, you know, better conditions at work. And they actually started to talk about the demands of the Civil War, not just being for the freedom of, like, African Americans, like slaves, but also for the freedom of workers in the north and the major industrial cities, on the basis that wage slavery, they're kind of connecting slavery and the emancipation African Americans with wage slavery. So it gets connected after the Civil War. There's quite a lot of struggles in 1867. That's where the first idea of the 8-hour day starts to appear. As I said, there was this depression, huge amount of immigrants coming over, and you get these formation of these unions, like, at that point. There's the KOL, which is the Knights of Labour, really much associated with the Irish Americans. You get the AFL, it wasn't actually called the AFL, I forgot the name before, it's the American Federation of Labour. That's much more of a straightforward trade union. The Knights of Labour had a connection to things like the Molly Maguires and these kind of groups of Irish workers who literally used riot and intimidation, sabotage, stuff like that, to try and get the demands. The KOL is connected to that, but becomes much more reformist. The AFL is kind of an amalgamation of unions, of trade unions, and again becomes fairly reformist. But within all these organisations, I'll come on to the third in a minute, there is, like, you know, they're like all unions, they contain, you know, sort of reformists right the way through to revolutionaries. So people move between them quite a lot, depending on which industries they were in, and sometimes connected to which ethnic group they were in. The International Working People's Association, right, is the smallest of those three in Chicago. It's founded in Chicago. And the IWPA is like the militant union, which is where the anarchist socialists in particular, at that stage anarchist socialists and some communists are joining. But it was set up by mainly anarchist activists in Chicago. It's definitely the most militant of those three unions. So they're the ones who are kind of putting forward the demands. And the IWPA is central to the fight for the 8-hour day. So they're the kind of organisations that are around. The struggle for the 8-hour day, obviously connected back to the Civil War, this has been rumbling on for like 20 years, this fight for the 8-hour day. And the key moment, I think, which changes after the end of the American Civil War, the key moment which changes the kind of relationship between the state and the employers and the working classes is the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. Unbelievable. I didn't know much about this till today, but it's really important because it showed, it was a real moment of intense class struggle in 1877. Now, the railroad strike is not just around the 8-hour day is one of the demands, but the other, what's going on is that because of there's various sort of recessions and, you know, slumps and kind of you know, growth periods in the American economy, but because there's a huge amount of investment into industry, and particularly in these places like Chicago, also in these other places you'll see under here, you get this point where the employers are actually reducing the wages, right? They get into problems. They reduce the wages by 10% around this time. That causes the Great Railroad Strike, but there's a whole load of demands which are central. The 8-hour day, it sits right between 1867 and the first demands for 8-hour day and what happens in the Haymarket in 1886. So a Great Railroad Strike, it's a national strike, right? So it's affecting all over, and it's obviously hitting the rail networks in particular. But what's very, very interesting about the Great Railroad Strike, there's a kind of impression we have in this country that when there's a strike, it's got to do with that particular industry. So, for example, the miners are on strike, the miners are on strike, no one else is on strike. And, you know, unemployed, everybody else is kind of not that important. But actually, the Great Railroad Strike is what I would call, if I'm having looked at it today, is open class warfare. So, for example, what's going on in these places, these are kind of key places where serious trouble broke out. Maryland is Baltimore, you know, Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, Illinois is Chicago, and Missouri, I can't remember. But they're the main centres, these big cities in there. But what's interesting is in this struggle, you're getting unemployed, you're getting, like, unwaged workers, you know, like, you know, women and stuff like that, or unwaged labourers. You're getting all sorts of people coming out and actually engaging in the strike along with the railway workers. Right? This is not a minor event. This is a major movement of whole communities supporting strikes rather than, you know, a particular sector. And that's partly because the demands are not just to do with the 10% reduction in wages, they're to do with these other things like the 8-hour day and a lot of other sort of social demands. Like, so it breaks out across America, but these places are where the key, and in Chicago it's a major deal as well, but these are the places where there are significant battles, not just between the police and strikers, but between militia, the National Guard, and federal troops as well. Unbelievable. So they all these are committed to try and break this strike, right? And effectively, they do it, the authorities, with ultra-violence, right? That's what they deal with, this strike. It's a serious event. If you click the next slide, I've got some pictures. I hope you can see them. Probably can't see them very well. But this one over here is, if you can see it at all, is from Baltimore. And this shows, like, a unit of American troops basically gunning down. Now, when I say there was fighting, hundreds of people were killed, possibly thousands wounded. So this is not a minor event, you know, in American history. I mean, I didn't know anything about it, but it's a major event. They're gunning people down. There's open warfare on the streets, and then there's a unit here crushing. This is Virginia, and this shows a whole load of people. Most of them weren't railway workers actually blockading the trains in Virginia, which is where the strike actually started. And this shot down here, I think, is in Pittsburgh, where the militia fought a three-day battle with the strikers, right, armed warfare. And the strikers eventually trapped them in the railway yards, in the depots, and then set fire to them. 135 buildings were burned down, with millions of pounds worth of damage. So they trapped the militia in there and set them alight, basically. And they had fought their way out. You know, it was, I don't know, about 60 or 70 injured. So in all of these places, I was looking through, and there's like 20 dead here, 20 dead there, but over days, you know, it really is really violent. And the authorities do get it under control using military force. And I think all I'd say is, if you want to read about American history, a lot of people don't know much about American history. I certainly didn't until fairly recently. And there's one book called Dynamite, if you've heard of it, by Lewis Adamick, which is it's definitely worth a read, because if you think American labour history has been a kind of history of unions dealing pleasantly with the employers, or they didn't need a socialist party or something because everything was nice, which is somehow the way it's portrayed, is completely and utterly wrong. The American class struggle from about 1850 to possibly the Second World War is one of the most violent struggles in the history of the world. So it's worth looking into. Anyway, if we move on then. So 1877 happens. It affects the way everybody thinks about strikes. Certainly politicises people. So it pushes people who are activists from being socialists or sympathetic to socialists into other more radical forms like communism and anarchism as a response. So I think the kind of difference is, rather than the idea that you're going to form a socialist party and get elected into, you know, or become a embroiled in bourgeois politics. There's a lot of people who are activists, labour organisers, who are moving the other direction, saying, well, 1877 taught us a lesson, and the lesson is we need to overthrow the state and overthrow capitalism, and we're going to do it with armed force, because we've seen what they do to us when we just want 8 hours or to fight against a 10% wage cut. They kill us. So that really did enter into the kind of psyche of the working class, the organised working class at that stage. And the fact that these people being gunned down weren't just strikers. They were, you know, their friends, their family, unemployed, you know, being gunned down as well. So, after 1877, the 8-hour struggle continues. There's things called 8-hour leagues set up, which these organisations are specifically targeting, like, you know, doing propaganda and pushing the whole idea of the 8-hour day. And through that period, the unions get more and more organised, and they start to pick on particular sectors. So, for example, I know they picked on the carpenters in Chicago and said, right, what we'll do is we'll get one section of workers and enforce the 8-hour day, right, with the employers. If we can get it through with one sector of workers, then that will mean that other sectors will be able to bargain for that 8-hour day on the back of that. Say, well, they've got it, so we can have it. So they have particular tactics to try and, you know, get the 8-hour day enforced. And what they do through this process is get to a point where they decide that May the 1st, 1886, will be the day that they bring the 8-hour day into Chicago, actually enforce it through the unions. I.e., people just wouldn't work more than 8 hours, and the employers will have to come to an agreement. And they call, and Chicago is the centre of the 8-hour day struggle across the United States, they call a national strike and demonstrations on May the 1st, 1886. In Chicago alone, 30,000 to 40,000 workers were on strike. Across America, probably about 500,000 people went on strike on that day. So about 30,000 to 40,000 workers went on strike on May the 1st, 1886. And there was something like around 80,000 people demonstrating in the centre of the city on that day. I mean, there's arguments about who did what, but it's one of the marches, which was about 40,000 strong, marched through the centre of Chicago, was led by Albert and Lucy Parsons, who will feature in the story in a minute. They were at the front with their children. So it was a major deal, and the organisation that was really at the forefront of this was the Independent Working People's, International Working People's Association. Now, I just want to say one thing about the IWPA, which you may have noticed, right? You may have heard of something called the International Working Men's Association, which is kind of the international. Well, something's changed here, isn't it? The word men's disappeared, and we got people, which tells you something. I mean, this is like 1880s, and the word man has disappeared from the description of the organisation, and it's become people. And that, to a certain extent, and that's a minor thing, does show you the progressive ideas that are in the anarchists and the more radical socialists and communists at that stage. They're actually starting to say, right, you know, we are addressing this problem of rights of women, right, which is on the agenda. And I've got to say, if you look at American history in particular, it is the anarchists and the communists who are really pushing this at that stage. So, interesting little change occurs, you know. On May the 3rd, so after these big strikes and demonstrations, there's an ongoing strike going on at McCormack Reaper Works, and I think it made combine harvester sort of things. Something like that, anyway. They've been locked out, the workers, going all the way through. There were other strikes going on, but they've been locked out since February that year. So they've been on strike, what's that, February, March, April? So 3 months or 4 months on strike. They've been fairly non-violent, but they've been locked out. So they've been demonstrating outside and picketing. And this is very important, what Amdon made it for. Again, I didn't really know about this until recently. But so there's a big demonstration going on. And what's going on in Chicago is the IWPA are kind of going round and sending their speakers, helping coordinate strikes and stuff like that. So I think August Spies, who you'll hear about in a minute, was actually at the demonstration outside the McCormack Reaper Works on May the 3rd, along with some of the other activists and obviously a lot of other labour organisers, anarchists who were there. And I think probably because of this feeling of power, the strikers decided to act on that May the 3rd. So the police tried to bring scab labour into the plant, and the strikers ran forward to kind of, you know, deal with them one way or another, either with verbally or with fists. And the police opened fire on the strikers. Nobody quite knows how many people were killed, but certainly two workers were killed, if not six. There's different reports. And the problem with those days was that, you know, there wasn't, healthcare was fairly basic, and obviously you had to pay for it. And thirdly, often people didn't go, if they were injured or shot by the police, they didn't go to the police. They were dealt with by their communities and their doctors and anarchists who deal with it, and socialists who would deal with this. So it's very hard to know how many civilians are killed in these incidents. A lot, because if you go to hospital, you end up getting arrested. Because being shot by the police in those days was kind of like a reason for getting put away, ironically. Because if you were shot by the police, you must have been doing something bad. So you'd get arrested. So people didn't go to hospital a lot of the time. So we don't know how many people were shot. Certainly a large number of workers were injured, if not, and somewhere between two and six were killed. August Spies spoke at this, the anarchist August Spies spoke at that, you know, event, and which, you know, he said afterwards, "I was very indignant. I knew from experience in the past that this butchering of people was done for the express purpose of defeating the 8-hour movement." So this event is key because it leads to what becomes the Haymarket Affair. So if you click the next one, sufficient. Right. So what do the IWPA do? These activists do? Well, after the shootings, they decided to call an emergency meeting the next day on May the 4th, and they put out these kind of flyers, you know, basically saying, we need a mass meeting, you know, good speakers will be present to denounce the latest atrocious act of the police, the shooting of our fellow workmen yesterday afternoon. And these are going around. You see, again, it's interesting in English and German, this one here, which was written by
August Spies
wrote this one, this flyer. And this one I don't know, but it was a lot of these were connected to a radical newspaper called Arbeiter Zeitung, which means Workers' Times, which will feature in the story. So they're kind of a radical newspaper which a lot of the anarchists were editing or writing for, or organising or printing. So they're knocking out all this stuff, saying come down to the Haymarket on May the 4th, and put them out, come down, we're going to talk about what's happened, we're going to debate about it. But also, interestingly, which features in what happens. There's a couple of problems with these posters, it turns out. Something worth, comrades might worth remembering in the future. For example, Revenge, Working Men to Arms, point out. And on this one, Working Men, Arm Yourselves and Appear in Full Force, the Executive Committee. So, just for the comrades, I don't know what you think, but it's probably best not to tell the enemy you're going to come with guns. Probably best to just bring the guns.
But anyway. Don't put it on Facebook either.
Yeah, don't put it on Facebook. Oh, yeah, bring guns tomorrow. You know. So, but there, I mean, there's obviously outrage, you know, and they feel the IWPA, they're on the crest of a wave here, you know, they really are leading this. The AFL and the Knights of Labour a little bit in the background, but many of their members are supporting these strikes and demonstrations. So they whack this stuff out, they call the meeting on the Haymarket. So do you click the next one? Well, there's a little map of Haymarket. I've got a picture of Chicago, but it's kind of right in the centre of Chicago. The Haymarket, like in this town, which is... Anyone know where the Haymarket is? In the city? Broadmead, yeah. So most cities have Haymarkets. They're usually quite big spaces because I guess there's a market for hay there at some point or other in the past. So there's the Haymarket here. The interesting thing is, of course, the actual... They decide, there's tram lines and stuff and things like that, so they actually decide not to have this meeting right in the middle of the Haymarket because it might disrupt the traffic. Right? So they decide to have it around a corner on this Des Plaines Street here. And in fact, this is exactly where they decided to put their wagon, where they stand on, you know, roll the wagon up, jump on top and start giving a speech. About 3,000, somewhere up to about 3,000 people turned up at this emergency meeting to hear about what happened in McCormack Reaper Works the day before, what we're going to do next, and stuff like that. So the meeting is about 3 hours long. Okay, so speeches, arguments, debates, and by after about a couple of hours, people start to drift away. You know, the last speaker's coming on, standing on this wagon, and the whole time the mayor is there. The mayor of Chicago is in the crowd, right? Famously, and listens to what they're saying. You know, he's not accosted or anything, he doesn't say there's any violence, no trouble, completely peaceful meeting of, you know, several thousand people. Anyway, people drift away. Towards the end of the meeting in the evening, there's about something like about 200 people left, okay? And mostly, sort of, well, a lot of them would have been IWPA sort of stalwarts, you know, people who are there, organisers and stuff like that. This place here is the local police station, one of the central police stations, Des Plaines Street Station right here. And just as this meeting's hitting about 3 hours, there's only about 200 people left. A detachment of 180 policemen came out of the police station and started to march towards the speakers here, on the, you know, where the crowd, small crowd is. So you've actually got about the same number of policemen as there are people there. It's almost equal, about 200 each. The policemen are armed, right, and they are in formation, and they march straight up towards to where this crowd is. At that point, the chief of police says, says something about breach of the peace, and they basically decide to violently disperse that demonstration. Again, I make no comment about what their strategy was, the police, but as far as I can tell, they waited till they got to a crowd they could handle, right? And probably thinking that they would get the organisers. Okay, and that becomes clear in what happens next. As they charge this this group of Labour organisers and demonstrators, somebody standing here throws a bomb at them. So they come up here and they charge the crowd. Somebody threw a bomb at them. I'll show you what the bomb looked like in a minute. But they chuck a bomb in there, it explodes, right? It's only small. Explodes amongst the policemen. Good shot, it was. I mean, he got it right in there. Very few demonstrators, if any, were injured by the bomb. It was only the police. So he threw it into this great phalanx of nearly 200 police. Explodes, and about 50 policemen are injured. But, you know, many, many minor injuries because it just exploded with shrapnel. One policeman is killed by the bomb. Right? I can tell you how he died. He died immediately. He died sometime afterwards, like a few hours or so later, because a piece of shrapnel cut his main artery in his leg and he bled to death. I mean, one policeman is actually killed by the bomb. But as soon as the bomb goes off, lots of smoke, it's at night, the police just start opening fire, okay, and they fire their guns for like something like about 3 or 4 minutes of sustained gunfire. Most of the witnesses, including policemen, point out that most of the shooting was coming from the police. So they're shooting into this crowd, and you saw that in that picture I showed at the front. So opening fire, shooting their guns, and it's kind of chaos. They also, in that chaos, the police managed to shoot 7 other policemen dead. Right? That's how chaotic it was, just chaos. There was one, apparently there's some reports that 1 or 2 people in the crowd fired back, right? But it's very, very limited accounts of that. I mean, it doesn't appear to be the police, you know, claiming this, but actually all the reporters and there and stuff like that just say, well, there was a couple of people maybe fired a gun, but basically it was a huge volley of shots. 180 people, maybe 50 of them wounded, and then, so you can imagine 100 people with guns opening fire on a crowd of 200. Loads of people were killed and wounded. I mean, the estimate, the police said there were definitely more civilians wounded and killed than there were police. So you've got like 7 or 8 dead, dying policemen. You've got 8 dying policemen. You've got probably about another 30, 40 minor who are wounded, right? And the police are wounding their own people as well. I mean, they killed 7 of their own people, but they also wounded loads of police. It was chaos. But meanwhile, there's volleys of shots flying into the crowd. And we don't know, but it's something like about 70 people were shot by the police that day. Something like that. Of which we know 4 or 5 definitely died, civilians, right? The people on the demonstration, but there was probably a hell of a lot more, because most of them didn't go to get to hospital. They were buried secretly, as the newspapers said. But the point was is that this was not like, I always understood it as a bomb, and then, you know, some policemen died because of a bomb. It wasn't. It was an absolute massacre. It was a chaotic massacre by the police of the demonstrators and of their own people. Crazy. So there's dead and dying everywhere. Everybody just scatters and runs. But what's very interesting is the police are trying to target people they know. So there's a guy who happens to look like Albert Parsons there, right? And they are going after him, shooting him. They're trying to gun them down. One of the speakers, I can't remember which guy it was now, one of the Haymarket martyrs, you know, actually gets shot in the groin because he's trying to stop his brother being executed. I mean, the cops get behind him and try and blow his head off, like, you know, because they're trying to kill these anarchists. That's what they're doing. And he dives in and stops his brother being killed and gets shot in his own groin, you know. It's literally this close. You've got to imagine, it's not like far away, volleys of shots, you know, Russian Revolution, so it's right on top of each other. It's like chaos. You imagine just one street. So everybody scatters, people run off, people are wounded, people are dying, other people are dragged off, people hide, you know, and that effectively is the end of the incident that night, okay, scatter. So if you click the next. Okay, well, I'm just going to come on to now what happens afterwards. I mean, I'm not going to go into great detail about the trial. What I'm going to talk about is the repression that occurred immediately afterwards. Hundreds of people are then rounded up over the next few weeks by the authorities. A massive red scare. The newspapers play this game of saying they're all, you know, sort of terrorists and the anarchists behind the bombing and, you know, blah, blah, blah. They justify it. They really play down the amount of civilians and demonstrators have been killed. That's why you don't know about it, basically. It's played down not only by the newspapers, but also for a long time by the historians as well. So, who do they go after? They nick lots of people. They beat lots of people up. And they get a fair bit of information. But it becomes clear that they're after certain people, and eventually they kind of nail it down to 8 people that they want, right? Now, I've put the Parsons up here for a couple of reasons. Lucy and Albert Parsons were married, they're activists. I won't talk about Lucy too much now. We'll come on to a minute. She wasn't actually in the trial, though she was arrested several times over that period, and I think if they wanted to go for her, they, you know, probably because she was a woman, they didn't do it because they thought they might create a martyr or something, so they didn't go for her. But they did go for Albert Parsons. He's sort of target number one. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about, very briefly, about Albert Parsons, so I don't ruin your talk. Just give you a little idea of who these people were they're targeting. So Albert Parsons was born in Texas. He fought in the Confederacy, fought for the Confederacy in the American Civil War. Meets Lucy, and is one of the founders of the International Working People's Association. Right, he also runs a newspaper, an anarchist newspaper called The Alarm, and he and Lucy led this big march on May the 1st in Chicago, 3 days before the Haymarket incident. So you click the next one, I'll leave Lucy till later. Right, this is the other group, the other seven people. I mean, you might notice straight away there's quite an interesting set of names here. Engel, Fischer, Schwab, Ling, Neeb, and not your normal American English names, German. So let's talk quickly through who these people were. Starting with, let's start with Oscar. So Oscar was an anarchist. He was born in New York to German parents. He was a tinsmith, apprentice, a factory worker, spent a lot of his time unemployed as well. And he was central, he was one of the kind of office organisers of the Arbeiterzeitung, the Workers' Times, which many of these people were associated with, which was one of the key, if not the key, publication of the International Working People's Association. Samuel Fieldens, one of us, interesting character, he's English, dad was a chartist. Samuel Fieldens was working in cotton mills when he was 8 years old in Britain. And I say that and put this in context of all these people because they'd all been through, you know, significant misery in their lives as working class people, but in all of the countries they've been in. He came to the United States and became a Teamster, that's a kind of lorry driver. In those days it probably been carriages, so I guess. And he was also central to the founding of the, he's involved in the International Working Men's Association, the International, but was also connected. He wasn't so much connected to the group as an anarchist, but he was connected to the IWPA as well. Michael Schwab, he was born in Germany, a German immigrant. He was the co-editor, or came to the United States, became in Chicago, eventually became the co-editor of Arbeiter, the Workers' Times, and also a founding member of the International Working People's Association. August Spies, who I've mentioned already, who was at the McCormack Reaper Works when the police opened fire the day before. Born in Germany. Most of these people, the German immigrants, came from very poor backgrounds. He was an upholsterer. He joined the Socialist Labour Party in the United States and helped sort of form it, I think, and was also involved in Arbeiterzeitung as a writer and an editor at one stage, and was a founder, one of the founding members of the International Working People's Association. The point about spies, really, is that, again, put it in context, was that 18 months before the Haymarket incident, his brother was killed by the police. I'm not sure of the circumstances, but you know, the point about this is there was a significant amount of death at that stage. People were being affected, their friends and family were being killed by the police. George Engel was a factory worker, again, born in Germany. He was involved in the International as well, in Germany and then in the United States. Again, came from extreme poverty, background of poverty in Germany as well, and came to Chicago in the 1880s. Adolf Fischer, he was a printer. He was co-editor of the Workers' Times, and but also was involved in, he was a printer by trade, and obviously was lining up all the printing work, and that's what he was involved in organising. Again, one of the founders of the International Working People's Association. And lastly, Louis Ling, who's probably the one that caused the most trouble in the court case for the defendants. He was a German, born in Germany, a carpenter, came from extreme poverty in Germany, an anarchist, and as we'll see in a minute, unfortunately, when his house was raided, they found a number of bombs being made. So he was the bomb maker, they called him, in the trial. Anyway, so we move on now. These are the people they accused. So the trial goes on. It becomes clear very early on to all those people there and across the world that actually they've gone for these eight people and there's significant problems with the evidence, but that's not going to hold the trial back. The trial concentrates on the fact that those posters were put out, you know, saying revenge and, you know, bring arms and all this stuff. It also concentrates on what people said in their speeches. You know, so people said, you know, we must stand up and fight or whatever it was. You know, that was used to say, well, that meant armed struggle. And there's no doubt about it that these people, although they were involved in, you know, major sort of labour struggles at the time, you know, believed at some stage it would come to some kind of armed confrontation. So they're not, you know, let's not get it wrong. They certainly didn't present that. I mean, Spies, for example, stands up at the McCormack Reaper Works and tries to, you know, stop the strikers attacking the scabs, you know, because he can see they're going to be gunned down. So I don't think these people were like, you know, firebrands for going out and, you know, sort of starting a, you know, armed struggle in some, you know, sending bombs through the post. They weren't that kind of people, but they were certainly not naive either, and certainly faced extreme violence over their lives, particularly in the US. So the outcome of the trial is, which is basically a show trial, they decide that all these people, all the spies, Parson, Fisher, Engel, Lingenfeld, Field and Schwab are sentenced to death, right? It's about 18 months after the Haymarket when, you know, when the executions are always going to be carried out. Ling manages to commit suicide in his cell by chomping on, it was a stupid thing to do actually, no disrespect to you, Ling. But he decided to kill himself by biting a blasting cap in his mouth, which is not a good idea because it blew half the side of his face off and it took him 6 hours to die. But he did say that before he died it was his happiest moment. Before he bit it, I guess. Maybe he died before they could execute him. Spies, Parson, Fisher and Engel were executed 18 months after the incident. Fielding and Schwabe were basically given death sentences, but they were commuted to life imprisonment. I'm going to come on to why these things happened in a minute. So their sentences of death were commuted to life imprisonment. Neeb got 15 years in prison. He was the only one that didn't get a death sentence initially. The 7 years after the incident, the governor of Illinois stepped in, and because there was such, you know, it was clearly a setup, the whole operation. And I've got to say, if you think about that paper keep coming up, doesn't it? Arbeiter's Eitan, these people are organisers. They're speakers and organisers, and they targeted them, right? And they, you know, I'll come on to why the evidence was all over the place in a minute, but they've clearly got this group out of hundreds of people that they were after. They've got this group of people, and it clearly becomes politicised across the world. The result is that even the governor of Illinois actually stepped in 1893 and pardoned Field and Neeb and Schwabe, obviously still in prison. They got pardoned, which was basically, he staked his political reputation on it, this guy, who was sort of liberal. It destroyed him, like, politically, doing that. But he did pardon them afterwards, which was kind of a mission by the state that it was a setup. And Spies famously said before he was hung, you know, the time will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you strangle today. And he's absolutely right. So we wouldn't be sitting here today, would we? And it wouldn't become May Day and all that. So that's kind of the outcome of the trial and everything. But let's come on to the more interesting bit, because we were having a proper row last night about this when we was discussing it. And this is the kind of bomb that was thrown. This was a bomb that, so it's not about that big. And they found, that's a bomb that was found in Ling's flat. He was grassed up by his flatmate. Let's keep an eye on your flatmates. And, you know, the question is that, well, let's look at what was actually, you know, let's look at the evidence, right? I mean, you know, okay, so was it the accused who did it? Well, the first problem is that Spies and Fielden were there. They were actually there at the incident, but they were both standing on the carriage and clearly didn't throw the bomb. So they were definitely there. Fisher and Parsons had left, you know, alibis. They'd left about an hour before it actually happened. So they weren't even there. Spies and Fielden were there, but not on the carriage. Fisher and Parsons had left. Parsons went for a beer. Fisher went for a beer, I think. Parsons went back to the Anarchist Social Centre place. Schwabe, Neeb, Ling and Engel weren't even there. They all had alibis. I think Schwabe was actually, he was giving a speech somewhere else. So he had like hundreds, thousands of people who'd seen him at that moment. So there were other meetings going on. And all these other people, Ling said he was home playing cards and had all his alibi. but there was enough, there was plenty of evidence. They just weren't there. So we've got, like, out of the eight, only two of them were actually there. But, I mean, you know, this is why the case was actually a complete joke, because, like, you know, it's all very well doing these people. But so what they were trying to say was there was a conspiracy, and the trial they tried to say they all met on the Monday night before and planned it all, and all this, but actually, you know, clearly none of these people threw the bomb. There's no question about that, you know, which is why it was seen for what it was, as a political show trial aimed at taking out main key Labour organisers and making an example of them. Right, this is where I get. I'm glad Kieran is near, because I proper rowed him last night. But I mean, I've read over the years and always anarchist stuff, and they always go, "Oh yeah, it was Nigel Provocateur who did it," you know, some copper for it, and it was just an excuse to try and get, you know, to allow them to open fire and stuff like that. They picked up. There's quite a few suspects, right? But actually, in terms of Agent Provocateur, there's only one figure who could have been an Agent Provocateur. And when I say suspects, there's quite a lot. I mean, there's probably, I read about 15 different people who are thought to be the bomb thrower. But of course, there's a big problem, isn't there, for the police, which is simple, really, which is that if you're deciding that you're going to go after these, like, anarchists and socialist labour organisers, you know, these radicals, and take them out, you don't actually want to find the bloke who did it, do you? Because the moment you find the bloke who did it, they're all got off, haven't they? And the only way you can do them is to get that person to say, yeah, they told me to do it or something, which is ridiculous. So after the case has really got its momentum going, there's, you know, in terms of the investigation, there's no reason to find the bloke who did it, or the woman or the bloke who did it, because, like, if you do, they all get off. So they didn't actually want to find the person. And it's very interesting now, looking back, because I personally don't buy the Agent Provocateur thing. There's a lot of debate about it. I don't believe that. You know, and there was another argument that it was a disgruntled worker. Well, that, you know, wouldn't surprise me either, right? Because obviously they may have been at the McCormack Reaper Works the day before and had a mate's gunned down by the police. So they might have turned up and read the post and thought, yeah, I am going tooled up. They told us to come tooled up, and we go tooled up because the police are going to do it again, which in fact is what appeared to be going on. In fact, what happened. They gunned them down. So that one, I don't know. But again, there's a few names come up. But, and then obviously, was it the anarchists? Well, if you ask me, the fact that it was a kind of the bomb that was thrown, there was some forensic evidence saying that it was the bomb that was similar, it was the same kind of chemicals that Ling was using, well, you know, and all this. I kind of suggest to me that it probably was somebody, one of the anarchists who was there. There were lots of suspects, but nobody was ever really picked up and properly, you know, nailed for it. Other people, for example, after the trial said they'd done it, people who were dying, you know, for various reasons, said I did it to try and get them off, but the state weren't interested. So I suspect, personally, my opinion is it was probably somebody went down there, probably somebody had been at McCormack Reaper Works the day before and seen a massacre, and had gone down there with a bomb and thought, well, you know, I've got a bomb in my pocket. If nothing happens, nothing happens, does it? And what they were doing was standing on that corner, and suddenly 180 police come charging down the street to attack the demonstration. They thought, oh, bingo, put it in there, and that was that. But we'll never know who it is. I don't think it will ever be known. And I think the point about all this is that this is somewhat irrelevant, because the point was they went and killed these people because of their political authority at the time, and also their political connections, and the fact that they were now leading massive demonstrations. You know, the IWPA is suddenly at the forefront of all this, literally within a few days. A lot of organising prior to that, when the May 1st thing kicks off, there at the centre of it. So, if you want to click the next one. Right, I'm going to stop there and hand over to Samuel, who's going to talk about Lindsay.
I've not done a talk before, so you'll have to bear with me. I want no shoes on because I stepped on paint outside. It's not how we do it in here.
Too much ejaculate.
Yeah. Right. So I'm going to do a bit of a talk about Lucy Parsons, who Roger's touched on. Lucy was a freethinker, a socialist to start with, a syndicalist, and an anarchist. She was a crusader for freedom of freedom, equality, solidarity. You know, I love Lucy, as Roger's pointed out. Like, she was born in Waco in Texas in 1953, and it's hard to find facts about Lucy's early life, because she was whenever being interviewed, she'd say and asked about her life, she'd say, "Well, it's not about me; it's about the cause," which is, like, it's a great thing to say. From a historical point of view, it's a fucking nightmare. Like. Yeah, so Lucy was of mixed heritage. So she's African, half African American, half Native Mexican Indian. and she lived in Waco. From my view, I think she was probably a slave. Probably, because it's Texas. It's before the Civil War, and she's mixed race. So, but there's no evidence for that. That's just a guess. And she lived with Oliver Gatherings, and he was a slave. So, I would guess that would probably be the case. Lucy. Also, the other nightmare thing about Lucy, historically, is that she uses lots of names, lots of surnames: Carter, Gonzalez, Hull. So it's very hard to trace a lot of her history. But we'll get on to her and Albert. They met in Waco, and as Roger said, he was a scout in the Confederate Army. He became radicalized. And got involved in radical republicanism and black suffrage. I mean, him and his brother were in the Confederate Army. There was actually there was a cavalry brigade named the Parsons Cavalry, which his brother was an officer in, his older brother. But when he left the Confederate Army, he left with a mule and came back to Waco and sold the mule, swapped it for land, a small amount of land, and got ex-slaves to work the land with him, which all his old friends, he didn't really like that, all the Confederate. Him and Lucy got married in 71, 72 in Austin. It's not clear how official the marriage was. And then living in Texas, they at the time had a lot of influence from the Ku Klux Klan, which, a mixed race couple with someone who had left with the Confederate Army was now working with ex-slaves. They got quite a lot of abuse, as you would. So they left and moved to Chicago, where they got involved in the Working Men's Party, the Labour Movement, and the Socialistic Labour Party, not the American Socialist Party, as you said earlier. And as Roger was talking about the 77 rail strike, again, I can reiterate, it's very important in American history, and had a massive impact on Lucy and Albert. Who were involved in socialist ideas before and fought, which you stated that looking back, reflecting, she wrote an article called Principles of Anarchism, where she reflects back on the 77 rail strike. She says that at the time she thought that power and the party can be used to used in a good way for the oppressor. I'm going to skip it because I'm getting a bit. That's all right. I'm new to this sort of thing, you see. So back to the railroad strike. It had a big impact on Lucy and Albert. Albert, because he was working on the print at the time, and he was working in a lot of different papers. And by being involved in it, the paper he was working for then blacklisted him with all other papers within Chicago, and said he's a commie and this sort of thing. He then left and started writing for a lot of the radical papers within Chicago. So while in Chicago, Lucy was working as a seamstress and got involved in, was one of the main organisers in the Working Women's Union, where she unionised other seamstresses. Is that a word? Seamstresses?
Yeah.
The same as any other trade, I would imagine, that they were making these beautiful dresses that they'd never be able to afford. And this is so they were easy to radicalise. Like, she was involved in the 80s. She was involved with the Knights of Labour. Roger touched on earlier, I would equate them to someone like the Respect Party nowadays, because they sort of groom these in my eyes, extremists, like Catholics. And even though they're a trade union, they have some very odd views, like the Respect Party. You know, they groom these extremists and talk about a lot of things that sound positive. But then a lot of members of that party have some very odd views. But yeah, that's the Knights of Labour anyway.
Demolish them.
It was around 1880 that Lucy and Albert started considering themselves anarchists. 1883, and they got involved in the International Working People's Association, which there was a paper then called Alarm, which was produced by the International Working People's Association, which Albert edited and Lucy wrote for. This is where Lucy wrote her famous article to the tramps, the unemployed, the disinherited and the miserable, where she urged poor and unemployed people to learn how to use explosives. I'll read you some of it. Let every dirty, lousy tramp arm himself with a revolver or a knife and on the steps of the palace. Every dirty, lousy tramp arm himself with a revolver on the steps of the palaces of the rich and stab them or shoot the owners as they come out. Let them kill them without mercy. Let it be a war of extermination without pity. Which is quite harsh, you know. It's quite,
He's a moderate.
Yeah.
Was a mess with that.
So after writing this, she was branded as a bit of a troublemaker. this brought a lot of attention to the paper and the group. Like Roger says with the trial, and this is before all Haymarket and all of that, I don't know why they didn't go after Lucy, because for me, the stuff Lucy was writing was the most militant, you know, and she, to me, a lot of anarchists don't really know a lot about Lucy. She's the most important, in my eyes, of all the anarchist writers. It's not like someone like Emma Goldman. To me, Emma Goldman, you know, what Emma Goldman was doing at the time was having these meetings with middle-class people about women's sexuality and being sexually free and all of this sort of thing, you know. Whereas Lucy was talking about the root of all the problems, which is class struggle. And that's the issue for me and for Lucy and for all of us, you know. All that other stuff is irrelevant, all your single issues and all that bollocks, you know, until we get control over our lives, every aspect of it, all of that's just a fucking, this reformist bollocks. Anyway.
I love Lucy.
But I'm only touching on Lucy because Roger messaged me though. This is why I'm a bit nervous and I haven't actually got a vast amount of information, but I will be doing another talk another day about Lucy because she's amazing. She was one of the founding members of the IWW, which is lovely. But, you know, one of the other things about Lucy is she died in 1942, which is like, that's not long. That's like tangible. It's like, it's not, I know, you know, we've got grandparents who were alive then, and it's...
She probably would get going. She died in a fire, didn't she?
She did die in a fire. Yeah, she died in a house fire, and her bloke, well, it was her lover, George Marshall, went in to go and save her, but couldn't, and died the next day of injuries and stuff. But there's loads more to her, and loads more. I'm not doing her justice with all of this. But if you're interested, there's a book called Speeches, Articles and Essays by Lucy Parsons, which is amazing. Anyone who considers themselves an anarchist should read The Principles of Anarchism by Lucy Parsons. It is the best thing ever written on anarchism. Even today, I read it recently on holiday, and it's the sort of thing you can show your friends who think this is all nonsense, like, you know, it's written in an amazing way.
That's great.
There
sense.
We go.
That's a sweet name. That's a sweetener for the forthcoming talk. Right, the second part is, I'm just going to, this is a bit more of a curveball, this one, but it's really looking at, we call it a tale of three monuments, but it's really to look at how the Haymarket's been remembered in Chicago, right, the centre point, you know, you think, so we're talking about memorials, monuments, commemorations here. This photo here, which you'll recognise, Samuel, is... the current, I'll show you in a minute what the actual, this is the current Haymarket memorial at the site of the, well, near the site of the bombing, which was put up in 2004, and a comrade asked us to lay a red rose there when we went out there, so that's what we did. If you want to click the next one. Oh, that was backwards, I think.
Oh, there.
No, here you go, next one. Right, can't see this very well. Might be able to pull the blinds down even.
Can you see all right?
Yeah, I can't tell from here. Right, this is the Hay. I'm going to show you three monuments now, which are all about contesting the history of the Haymarket event. So this monument was put up in 1887, so it was a year afterwards, and well, it must have been just after these guys were executed, the spies. What was it? Spies, Parsons, Ling, or killed himself, Fisher. Engel, and it's put up. Now, it's not actually at the site of the monument. They weren't basically allowed to put a monument up at the site of where the Haymarket incident occurred. So this is put up, I think it's Forest Hill Cemetery, which some of us visited last year. And, it's got a fairly dramatic monument. It's got names on it. It's got Spies' quote, you know, we will, you know, you try and strangle us now, but we're going to be bigger than you historically as a result. So that's the first monument, so bear that in mind. So that's about, I don't know, it's about 5 miles away from the actual scene. It's in West Chicago. Amazing graveyard. I'll come on to why in a minute. But anyway, that's a central monument. That is like kind of, I suppose you could argue, our monument to it. And that's where it was. So not at the site. And the next one, this is the police monument, right? Which was put up in 1896. I think that's the when it's been finished. So this is a monument to the guy, I think it was Deng, I think his name was Matthew Deng, who was the cop who got the bit of shrapnel on his leg and then bled to death. So that was put at the site in the Haymarket, or close to the site in the Haymarket. And the third one is this one, which was put up in 2004, actually close to the actual site of the Haymarket. And this memorial was meant to kind of balance the history a little bit. That's the plan, right? So the money's put into this by the state, and it's built. that's it. And that's where we laid the flowers and stuff like that. So they're the three monuments. We've got the one that was put there originally in 1897, the police one 1896, and then this one very recently. Now I found it amazing that for really, I think how come it took till 2004. To put up a monument to this event, which is now worldwide known, you know, it's worldwide, major historic event, you know, it leads to May Day and all that stuff. We haven't talked about all that process, but becomes this very, very important history event in Labour history. So how come it took until 2004 for this monument to arrive? And I'll kind of explain why, because it's a bit of a checkered history. You click the next one, I can't remember what's next. Oh, if you go back then. Right, I'm just going to read you a little bit of history now of what happens with these three monuments. So if you go back to that one, that'll do. We're going to be talking about the police one quite a lot. The one before the police. That's the other way. Oh, that one. Oh! Can you go backwards? Oh, that'll do. That'll do. Come on, if you can find the copper monument, that'd be good. Which is that's good, the other way.
Okay, the wrong way.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So, don't find these three monuments. One in the cemetery miles away. One at the spot, the police one, and then one that's put up in 2004. Right. When they're building this statue, the state and private donators, imagine the bosses probably put a fair bit of money into it. when they were building this, there's a whole series of incidents that occur. First of all, 1888, they're building this monument. They found an unexploded bomb in the building site. Okay, so that was a bit odd. Somebody apparently tried to blow it up, but failed. The monument up the year after. In 1890, they found unmistakable traces of an attempt to blow the statue up. So that's twice they've had a go at it now, within a couple of years of the event. In 1893, the monument in the cemetery appears, you know, and eventually is completed. And in 1903, this monument is continually vandalised, but the main thing is these crests, state crests and stuff, were stolen off the monument several times, but notably in 1903, where all the crests were stolen off it and they never recovered. Every time they put the crest back on, they got nicked or vandalised. 1927, on May the 4th. Now, when I heard about this story, right, I just saw the date 1927, right? And the story is, in 1927, this monument is knocked completely over by a tram, right? Now, you think, somebody said, Kieran said to me last night, you can't run a monument over a tram because they go on rails, right?
Yeah.
But what happened was, is the guy went really, really fast and took it off the rails, right, and threw the statue, right, knocked it over. Now, I just thought I'd check the date out when that happened, and funnily enough, it was May the 4th. Which is the anniversary, right? 1927, May the 4th. And then I found out what the driver said afterwards, which he said he was sick of seeing that policeman with his arm raised, so he decided to take it out. I mean, you know, no disrespect to the anarchists with their bombs and everything, but that is quality. I'm going to take it. I mean, they blow it up a bit, take a tram for it, and that's what the geezer did. Right? So he basically had enough of it. And, you know, I don't believe that it was just a coincidence it was May the 4th. You know, I mean, obviously he wasn't going to say that, was he? Oh, yeah. But he said, I got sick of it and I took it down. So he, you know, cheers. Find out, I don't know the guy's name. We've got to find the bloke's name because, you know, he needs to be remembered, doesn't he? Put a tram through the policeman. The police monument was then repaired and it was moved for a long time away from that site. It was moved into a park. And in 1956, they decided to move it back. And they put it on a new pedestal right near the bombs, where the bomb went off in the Haymarket, and there's planes. So it gets back, it's 1950s now, they've got it back into the location they want it after the accident with the tram. In 1965, on May the 5th, so that's tomorrow, 1965, Mayor Daley, you may have heard of, he unveiled a plaque it was declared this monument historic landmark, this monument, and they wrote back with the name of all the police officers that were killed in the Haymarket incident. Obviously, perhaps not remembering that seven of them were killed by the police themselves, but anyway, they put the name of the eight coppers who died and up on this thing. It was, you know, kind of attempt by the authorities, Mayor Daley and all that, to try and popularise the police and, you know, bring this back onto the agenda as a terrible attack on the police. 3 years later, on May the 4th again, the monument was badly damaged during a Vietnam War protest when people threw black paint all over it. So the vandalisation is starting again. Now, 1969, the Illinois Labour History Society, right, started lobbying the city, saying that we want a proper memorial. It's kind of in reaction to this, you know, the mayor's event. You know, we want our memorial on the site, not just this copper. So they start this campaign to try and get a permanent monument from the other perspective on the site. In 1969, October 1969, this statue is blown up by the Weather Underground. I won't go on about the Weather Underground too much. If you know anything about it, they come out of Students for Democratic Society, decide to declare war on the state, mainly due to the Vietnam War, but they become anti-capitalists and revolutionaries, inverted commas. So they blow it up, and I mean, I looked at where the Underground were up to this stage. That was literally 2 days before the Days of Rage, if anybody knows anything about the Days of Rage. It's basically where the Weather Underground and members of the SDS decide to take the war in Vietnam onto the streets of the US, and what they meant by that was mobbing up and smashing the hell out of not only the police but also all the all the financial districts. And in Chicago that happens, fair play to them, they had a pop. You know, it's brave. So the idea was to take militant violent action onto the streets of the US in reaction to the US involvement in the Vietnam War. So bring the war home was the slogan. So just before those events, the Days of Rage, they blow up the police statue. So a year later, right, the monument is reinstalled, they repair it, they redo the statue, and thanks to private donations and funding from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters and other unions, the police get their statue back. Repaired, yeah. The International Brotherhood of Teamsters and other unions put money in to helping restore the police statue, which is the only monument at the bomb site from, you know, what happened. That's over the next months following the Weather Underground bombing. In 1970, one day before the anniversary of the Weather Underground bombing, in October, the Weather Underground blew it up again. So they've just got it all back, a little sort of the ceremony. And this time they do a proper job. They blow it to fucking pieces, basically. So there's consternation at this point, because the statue's been blown up twice in a year, that this is going to carry on. So they decide, the city leaders decide to protect, they have ideas about how to protect the beleaguered statue, right? The first one was to install it inside a plastic dome. So they would have put a huge plastic dome over it. Which is a bit weird, because you think, well, you probably wouldn't be allowed in, would you? I mean, you'd have to sort of stand outside and look at the monument. That was one idea. The other idea, which I think is really kind of interesting, because it kind of connects with sort of mass production, post-war mass production, they decided to make a large number of fiberglass replicas, mass produce them. So they'd stick one up, you'd have to smash it up, keep banging them up, like, you know. Anyway, they knocked those two ideas on the head as being impractical, but they did decide, Mayor Daley, to order a 24-hour, 365-days-a-year police guard on the statue, which cost at that stage $67,000, which I guess is for several hundred thousand dollars now, to protect this statue. So the coppers standing there all the whole time protecting it. That went on for some time, until 1972, when the police decided they probably couldn't afford it by that stage because of the oil crisis beginning. So they decided to move the statue into the central, in front of the central police headquarters, but it still wasn't safe. So in 1976, they moved it into the Chicago Police Training Academy, inside, inside the fences and everything. Meanwhile, the Illinois Labor History Society have got, you know, get ownership of the Haymarket Monument, the one that's in the cemetery, so they're kind of looking after that now. So this is progressing, this campaign, to get something. In 1985, various committees, Haymarket committees and the Illinois Labor History Society asked to get a park at the site. You know, they're fighting all the time to get something. And finally, in 1992... the site of the Haymarket bombing was declared a historic landmark by the city of Chicago. So not based around this statue as being a historic landmark, but just the location. Now, where this statue used to be, when it was moved, blown up and all that, there was a kind of, they left this bit, this sort of stuff, this bottom bit, I think this plinth here was left in place. So there were various actions against the remainder of where the police statue had been. Including in 1996, they were doing some sidewalk renovation at the site close to the statue, and an artist got in there and managed to fool the people who were working there to installing a small hand-cut mosaic dedicated to the anarchist martyrs. So obviously had a letter from the council, the suit on, and said, we put this down, it's got to go in there. They stuck it in, it was there for 5 weeks before the council realised. So this is 1996. 1997, 2000, eventually, after all this campaign, the state of Illinois contributed $300,000 towards a memorial at the bomb site. Okay. In 2001, during, this is into our time now, isn't it? Or your time. 2001, during a May Day celebration, a performance artist known as René Areco, he went to the site where this statue was and repeatedly jumped on the plinth and stomped for several hours on it. And this is where the police monument, it became known as the Areco Stomp, a new dance, and became fairly famous in Chicago. It made a lot of press, and you know, so people went there and did the Areco Stomp on it. 2 years later, a large number of flash mobs sort of turned up with another artist and did 8 hours of stomping or something, which I think I guess something to do with the 8 hour thing. And finally, in 2004. And they unveiled the monument I showed you, the one that was meant to balance it all and stuff like that. So that, and the last thing that happened was 2007, they put the police monument, a new police monument, and I haven't seen it, I didn't find it, but it, they did install a police monument, not at the bomb site, but fairly close. So, the point about all this is that you obviously see it's been contested at all different levels, this, right? So we've got, you know, we've got various, you know, groups and, you know, fighting and campaigning over 100 years. And the point about this is that this is still ongoing, right? I mean, there's still a battle going on. Who is going to have that site? Now, the police have obviously done a deal, got their statue or their, what they want somewhere fairly close. The Illinois Labor History Society, a lot of other campaigners for, you know, more than 20 or 30 years even, have been fighting and got a monument which is some sort of, like, postmodernist attempt to try and portray it. But what was interesting when we were actually in Chicago and talking about it was, first of all, the fact that more people probably know about the Haymarket in Bristol than you would find on the streets of Chicago. Right? It's interesting. It's more of a European history. We know about this stuff. In America, you go to Chicago, it was very clear to all of activists, some people just don't know about it. And that's not surprising if you think about it, because actually, you know, although there's been struggles since the 60s to get this statue there, the main memorial is hidden away in a cemetery, which most people don't go to. And, you know, this has been the dominating impression, and then that's disappeared as well eventually. So there is a real lack of knowledge about the Haymarket incident in Chicago, and a lot of people complained about that. The last thing I want to do is just show a picture of, as you saw earlier on, so there's the memorial they got, the 2004 memorial, and it's there. I don't know what you make of it. I guess it's a carriage and some people speaking, and I don't know what's going on down there, but whatever. Anyway, so that's what's there at the moment, and you know, there's been various demonstrations around that on May Day and stuff like that. But the events in Chicago on May Day are very small, okay? They're, you know, probably smaller than this city, so there's a lack of knowledge about it. Next one, right? This is some pictures of. I just want to bring you on to a little spat that which is related to this stuff, because what I'm trying to say is we might be fighting over the history. You know, with the civic authorities about what history is remembered, and it's very important to carry those battles on because, you know what was it somebody once said, who controls the past controls the present, who controls the present controls the future. So it is important to carry on these battles, to remember the history and not retain it just in our little ghettos. It's got to be out there. People have got to know about this stuff. People should know about the 1877 strike in America, whatever. It's important to know this history. But also there's battles going on right through this time about within the movement itself, within the labour movement, within the left, and within, you know, sections of the anarchists as well. And this is a good example of it, right? So we go to the Forest Hill Cemetery to go and find the memorial, and there's a rubbing here, which was taken, you can have a look at in a minute, of the Haymarket monument in Forest Hill Cemetery. But, so we're hunting around, and this cemetery is mental. If you want to go to a cemetery in America and have fun, if you're a lefty, it's brilliant. Because you walk around going, oh, God, you see the monument, and, you know, bloody hell, Emma Goldman's little monument, and this is to Emma Goldman. You walk around and go, half the Lincoln Brigade who fought in the Spanish Civil War are there, the Communist Party, everybody's there. IWW is wobblies left, right and centre. Right? It's great. I mean, Steve will tell you afterwards, and, you know, if we had a wicked time. So I'm hunting about thinking, I reckon Lucy's here somewhere. Lucy Parsons must be here somewhere, right? Because everybody else is there, her husband's there, and all this sort of stuff. And Emma Goldman's got this big deal and all that. And eventually I found Lucy Parsons' grave, which is this little stone. Yeah. It's that big, because there's a rubbing of it. It's that big, it's about the size of an A3 bit of paper. And I got really upset, because I thought, as far as I'm concerned, she's one of the most important radical activists in American history, right? And that's what she gets, right? A little tiny stone. When everybody else, it was the smallest grave and the, you know, the least important stone in the whole of this massive cemetery full of the Communist Party, the anarchists, everybody's there, right? This is a monkey here. He thinks it's funny. I'm sad. But the point about this is I thought, I don't have a little look at this. What's going on here then? Why does Lucy not know? Is Lucy no more in the Europe? And I spoke to the activist in Chicago and said, yeah, Lucy's no more about in Europe. And actually a lot to do with the activities of class war in the 1980s, then Lucy Parsons is known a lot more about Europe than known about in the US. And I was like going, why is that? Why does Emma get this fucking great monument and she gets a little tiny stone? Because I'd have it the other way around, personally. But what I found was, I looked into the history of Emma Goldman and Lucy Parsons. Right? And as, Sammy, I won't ruin too much of your future talk, but one of what I noticed was there was a huge row between the anarchists around Emma Goldman, and Emma Goldman, and Lucy Parsons, right? And the row was very simple. It went like this. They were arguing politically, and Lucy Parsons said, you know, basically the problem you've got, Emma, is you're talking about all this useful stuff. It is useful, but you're talking to the wrong people, right? That's what she said. You're talking to this stuff you're talking about, contraception, but you know, all the birth control of reproductive rights, all this sort of stuff. You're talking to the wrong people. You're talking to the middle classes. What is the point of talking to those people? You know, it's pointless, and it's all very nice. And you know, everybody's, you know, it's okay for you to do that, but you're not talking to the right people. You're not talking to the working class, like, and that's what I'm doing, and that's what we're all doing. That's why we don't do that. And unfortunately, Emma Goldman said, back to her, said, well, the problem with you is, Lucy, you've got no politics. You've just been hanging off the coattails of your dead husband for the last 30 years, 20 years. So,
which, for a fucking feminist, to say to another feminist, that's worse than saying cunt. It's a fucking horrible thing to say.
It's a terrible thing to say. So they weren't getting on all right. Now, it seems to me that the other problem, Lucy, that's one problem, right? So the anarchist movement is divided, if not sitting on Goldman's side. And you know, and the other problem is that Lucy Parsons famously never trapped herself in one particular ideology. She, you know, what she did, I mean, although she obviously, you know, went from, you know, abolitionism and, you know, fighting for the freedom of slaves all the way through to be a socialist and an anarchist, but she also, you know, she never limited herself to purely the ideological position, the ideological organisation. She wanted to organise in the working class, and that's what she did. I mean, and consequently, she wasn't picky about, you know, hanging around one particular group. She organised in the working class. Consequently, towards the end of her life, she was knocking around with a lot of communists in the 20s and 30s. And she never joined the Communist Party.
No, she didn't join the Communist Party.
But the point is, she's aimed. So now what's interesting is Lucy. Now, I looked at this graveyard, right, and I looked around for all the CP members have got proper fucking deal, you know, graves, right? Working class, labour organisers, the Communist Party have got fucking graves. And they look like they've been paid for by the party. And they've also looked like they've been made by the same people. So, you know, they're being looked after. She wasn't a member of the Communist Party. She didn't get that. Similarly, because she pissed all the anarchists off because they were all going, oh, she's a communist now, which wasn't necessarily true, she also didn't get fuck all. So she ended up with fuck all. Now that to me is an interesting history, because how many other people like Lucy Parsons are there in the world who don't, you know, fall into being defended by one ideological group or another? And what happens to them? They fall between the cracks, and often they're the people who are actually organising the working class, and they don't get remembered. And Lucy, you know, made me sad. Didn't it, Steve? And that's the end of the talk. So,
thank you.
Are there any questions?
Isn't there a film about when they unveiled the new statue? Because I saw that, and they had someone from like the Police Federation.
That's when they happened. We never forgive, we never forget. And there's graffiti on it, and actually on top of the statue there was a strike poster, IWW strike poster above it. Yeah, there is a film. I haven't seen it, but what there is this pamphlet, which I think is somewhat connected to the film, which is about the history of remembering the Haymarket in Chicago, which is where a lot of this stuff. Well, certainly the timelines and stuff like that, so it's worth having a look at. Anyway, what was your question?
No, that was it. It was just like, yeah, because there was another row at the other thing.
Raucous, they called it.
Was it? Yeah.
The cemetery, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it just,
between the left and what
it was the unions and a couple of these anarchists who weren't. The most they were a little bit socially awkward, but they got their point across.
It was the state, the city of Chicago, a state trying to say, "Oh, we're gonna commemorate May Day and the Haymarket," and they were like, "Well, no, fuck off, because actually we were fighting you lot."
But they didn't let an anarchist speak. But then when you saw the anarchists, you saw
it was a bit. But that was the reason, wasn't it? They were trying to say, "Oh, this day part of our it's our history." And they would say, "Well, actually, no, it's not. It's not your history. You know, it's like this is out of order. You know, you shouldn't be do, you know, it's like part of a tourist board or something. You know, come to Chicago to see the May Day thing. That was the big reason they didn't like it, I think. They spat on it, didn't they? Some guy spat on, I don't know, spat on the plaque or something, if I remember.
Yeah, struggle continues.
Just curious, when is the talk on Emma Parsons?
Because I'm not sure. When is the talk?
It'll be soon.
It'll be very soon.
It'll be soon, yeah.
Okay, cool. So we'll have to get on to that.
Is there any sort of movement at all to do anything with that green stone or that one? Is there?
Well,
the people you met out there, were they?
Well, it's funny, I did a talk, and I did it. One of the talks I did was on. When I do talks about radical history out of the States, we generally try and choose something local. Do talk about maybe stuff we've done, but also talk about something local. A couple of things that, which we did everywhere we went. We picked on something, you know, like we went to look at, you know, the Battle of Fallen Timbers, if you know about it, in Detroit, which is where the indigenous tribes gathered together and were eventually defeated by the settlers and the US Army. But what I didn't know is 3 years before that, they actually slaughtered the US Army there. So Fallen Timbers has three monuments, you know, one to the glorious white settlers for killing these, you know, the Red Indians, one to, like, there was a battle here, and the third one was recognising all the indigenous groups, you know, you could leave tobacco as an offering and all that. So these sites are contested, and so I always used to bring up in the meeting and say, well, look at that, you know, there's something to be written there, isn't it? Because that's exposing different ideological positions about history and how it's changing and stuff like that, and the dates are important, you know. But what I did do was I thought, well, I'll bring up Lucy Parsons then. So in the meeting, I did a meeting, and I said, right, my example of something that needs to be done, because of two, I thought you just held up, you know, who's that? We held up the rabbit, who's that? You know, does anyone know who Lucy Parsons is? And it was amazing, it's a room full of activists, and only about a third of them really knew anything about her. Which was shocking, actually, because it was your city, you know, she was central to it. So what I said was, well, there you go, you know, that's a job to start with, you know, we've got to, you know, pick these figures up and start, you know, talking about them, like, you know, and you need to talk about them in your city, because, I mean, to me, she, you know, like Samuel said, you know, Native American, African American, you know, she covered all the bases, really, if you want to get into some kind of ethnic American argument. She covered all the bases, amazing figure, you know, transition from slavery through to industrial capitalism. She's right there in the centre of all this, and she's, you know, all that. So why don't we even know about her? So I was trying to stir them up. And I think, well, there has been some stuff that's happened, but it'd be great to whack some bigger, you know, something a bit more, some kind of memorial to her somewhere would be great in Chicago. And I know there's, you know, there's some good people there doing stuff. But again, I think she falls between the anarchists and the communists, which is problematic. You know, I really think it is. I think that, you know, you get different activists want to emphasise different people. Yeah. I know you might disagree with that.
I will disagree
with
you. We're not going to get to that area.
I think that is a problem for, you know, so... But then that's, you know, I'm not interested in that. It's a history, isn't it? You've got to get it out, so...
Because when they had the plaque things, they had a woman dressed up as Lucy Parsons when they were on the film.
That's where I think the I Love Lucy from.
Yeah, and the and when they unveiled the new... monuments, they had a woman, I think it might be the same woman actually, doing some of her
speech. She got really, really into the history. Dave?
Sorry for coming, but two good talks, and I didn't know about Lucy Parsons, so thanks for that. A couple of kind of connecting things that occurs to me. Has anybody heard of Thomas Helica? Because in 1803, he was an 18-year-old lad who worked in a woolen mill in Trowbridge called Staverton Mill. And on his 19th birthday, he was hung because the mill got burnt down. And he got hung in Salisbury, not because he was guilty. He wasn't even there, probably, but because he refused to name names. And on his 19th birthday, he was hung. And the woolen workers of Trowbridge carried him across Salisbury Plain back to Trowbridge. But the connection is... But if you go to Trowbridge Parish Churchyard, there is a monument. So I found Roger's bit on the graves, really interesting. There's a monument to Thomas Helliker, this 19-year-old who was hung for so-called burning down the big mill in Staverton, which is still there, by the way. And the mill owners, about, I don't know, 20, 30 years later, got a great big tomb, and there's a plaque there, a marble plaque, which says, "He was repentant." And I don't know how long later, Roger might know, but like 50 or 60 years later, the workers of Trowbridge got together through the unions and paid for another marble monument on the other side of the tomb, saying he wasn't repentant at all, and he was totally innocent. So it's quite a rare example in the West Country of what Roger was on about in the cemetery. Yeah. And, you know, if you're passing through Trowbridge, have a look at the parish church. It's got a great big spire, and the tomb's there. The other thing is, I wondered, you know, in this company, what people think of the idea of defending the May Day, Monday bank holiday. Because I think that if Cameron gets in again, he will definitely abolish it. And I think probably we're all agreed that it's a very, very shoddy compromise to have any celebrations of International Workers' Day, which goes back to the Haymarket, on the nearest Monday and kind of the official bank holiday. There's something kind of rotten about that, isn't there? But it is a bank holiday which is supposed to be, you know, representing some connection with International Workers' Day. And whilst personally, I think it's probably much better to have 50 people at an event like this on the 1st of May, even if you have to go to work first, yeah, than 500 people or you know, what quite often is less than 500 people marching. But I just wonder what people here thought about, because the TUC and the official part of the trade unions will definitely have a campaign to try and defend that May Day bank holiday. And I just wondered if people here thought that was worth defending or not.
It's a call to arms.
Revenge. I'll come to you, Charles, don't worry. I don't know, personally, I think, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the most important thing is to see it for what it is like, how are they trying to push it into the bank holiday? Because obviously it's meant to be, it's a workers' day, the day off. Right, so they're obviously still playing this bloody 8-hour day game, aren't they? They're trying to limit our holidays into things that are already time that's lost anyway and factored into their like sums. And it's like, well, no, actually, we want that fucking day as well. That's the point. We'll have both. And if it happens to fall on the same day every now and then, well, whatever. But the rest of the time, we want that day, don't we? So I think that's the way I'd approach it. I mean, I think Dave's right. I mean, they're trying to push all this stuff. And my problem with it is simple, really, which is that if they go, well, you know, it was big, you know, 50 years ago, it was big 70 years ago. I mean, look at the rest of the holidays we've got. I mean, you know, it's not... I mean, what are they? What is August the 30th?
Yeah.
You know, the last... What is it? Is it what's that called? The bank holiday end of August?
August.
No, it's called something, isn't it? Whitsun. I mean, you know, that's a major festival these days, isn't it? So my actually, the argument it's not that popular or something is rubbish, right? Because it's like, well, there's loads of holidays that aren't popular as popular festivals anymore. We've still got them.
But did they want to replace, isn't the idea, Roger, that they're going to replace it with a patriotic day and try and make that? That's the possible argument for defending it.
Well, I think that's definitely, yeah, I've heard about that. I mean, I wasn't sure how serious they were about doing that. I don't know if people know about that. But you reckon they are?
It's a foreign holiday, anyway.
So, yeah.
Give us another bank holiday.
Yeah,
we'll have another one. Well, we have to move one.
But yeah, I think if it does come up, I mean, if they do follow through this plan and turn it into Patriot Day or something, then we need to do something.
That's what I mean. I think there'd be a battle one way or another, but whether we want to defend what we've got, which is compromised, or just attack what they're proposing, is a kind of tactical thing, isn't it?
Sorry, could you... Oh, yeah. I was going to say, going back to Lucy Parsons, you say about the squabbling between whether Lucy Parsons was a socialist or anarchist. I don't think either of the two of those labels really matter at the day, because what she did do, from what you what you've shown us, is a tremendous amount of work for the working class people, basically. So, I mean, even if the anarchists and communists can't agree which side she was on, surely they can both come to realise that she actually did a hell of a lot for around
exactly,
that time.
Yeah.
Well, she started off as a socialist.
Yeah.
But then she stopped being a socialist because she was anti-state. And this stuff about her being a commie, right?
Yeah.
This is the where this comes from. There was a book written in the 70s by a woman who basically picked out of the air, because Lucy was friends with communists, she must have been in the Communist Party.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, there's no evidence of this. Mm. And the Communist Party at the time was, you know, their phrase was... you know, communism is Americanism, you know, which Lucy was anti-state. They used to sing Stars and Stripes to the flag, like, you know, whatever Lucy's other views were, she was completely anti-state, like, you know, in this sense, as something to praise, like, you know, unlike the communists at the time, because, they wanted to show that they were American. Yeah. So that side of it is sort of irrelevant. But you know, she states throughout all of it, there's points where she's in the principles of anarchism that it shouldn't be fixed. Anarchism shouldn't be fixed, and it is about it's about. I can't remember the quote exactly, but it's about moving on, and should that ideology become obsolete for us as a class, then we move on.
Yeah, and well, that's the key point. So I think it places her within you know, her drive with what was actually happening.
Yeah.
Not like, you know, fighting these ideological battles in, you know, groups of middle class people, you know, like Emma Goldman was. I mean, I've got to be careful with slagging Emma.
Obviously,
too
Emma
much,
Goldman
but, like,
did a lot of very
really
good things
stuff.
As well. She's done some brilliant writing, but it's that. Yeah,
it's all
like what you were saying, that thing is about, you know, Lucy spent, I did hundreds of meetings, thousands of meetings, she talked all over the country to everyone, to all sorts of different people, but the majority was the working class. She came to Britain as well, right? She was in Scotland and maybe Bristol, but there's no evidence of her coming to Bristol, I'm just guessing, probably Fishponds.
Liverpool,
she came to as well. But she, you know, she
didn't
was
go to Fishponds.
You don't know.
Oh.
It's
not to say she didn't go.
But yeah, that is the difference, and I think, like Roger was saying, it's about real life. You know, it's not about. I've got this theory about how we should run the world. It's about what works within our day-to-day life and what's organic. Like, you know, there's no point in saying, you know, we should trust this person and vote them in to rule over us, because that's what ideologically as a communist I think, or whatever, like, you know, if it works for us on an everyday level, then it works, and once it doesn't, we fucking get rid of it and move on. Like,
I also don't think she was that sectarian. I mean, I know she had her ideas. What I mean is, she had her ideas, but she wasn't going to limit herself in terms of actual struggle to just dealing with people who shared her political ideology. How could she? She started as a seamstress organising Eastern European Jewish garment workers who couldn't speak English. So, I mean, she didn't even know what they fucking thought, probably. But she started organising regardless. That's what she did. Like, you know.
And because, however, you know, a lot of people talk about the differences. I'm sure there's a lot of people who consider themselves socialists who really they're probably anarchists, and people who believe themselves to be anarchists, and their views lie more in socialism. Like, you know, there's not huge amounts of. Go on.
I don't think it's like wise to stereotype people as anarchists or socialists. If they act and if they do something they believe, I think that's what matters. So not necessarily what the hell, they're an anarchist. Right, they're an anarchist. But if they fight for what they believe, I think that's what matters.
If you're given a system, then what form of government, you've got to have some kind of form of government or some kind of way of running society. So what kind
of
form is going to take, it will be the debate will happen after getting rid of all the class, the debate of what we have after. But you've got, but the thing is, the ruling class will be out to get us. So we've got to have a strong
which brings me nicely onto tomorrow's meeting, which I think you should come down to. Tomorrow's, sorry?
Just very quick.
All right, Quentin, you've got 2 minutes.
I don't think there's necessarily a division between keeping this compromise made day and going first. I think you can do both, and I think it's more relevant than ever, because the ideal 8-hour day is going out the window with people being sacked for not working 12-hour days, 6-day weeks.
Oh, no, yeah.
I'm sure we won't be fighting for a 4-hour day, because it's been over 100 years. We're still stuck with the 8 hours.
Yeah, we haven't gone much further, have we, really? Further, have we, really?